from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
And this album, somebody handed it to me on this one particular winter, which was the first winter that I knew about sadness, like really knew about it.
From Louisville Public Media, this is Five Things, the show that tells a life story through the objects we treasure. I'm Tara Anderson. My guest this week is a singer-songwriter and a one-time stay-at-home dad. It's rare that anybody asks musicians who are also mothers how they balance it all. So I was really happy to talk with Clarence Bucaro about how having children affected his life and career. He's also encountered some tough breaks over the course of his musical journey, so you'll hear about those too, and how he got through them.
This is Clarence Bucaro, and I'm a singer-songwriter, originally from Cleveland, Ohio. And since then, I've lived in New Orleans, in Los Angeles, in Nashville, and New York.
You have a new album out, is that correct?
I have a new album, yeah, Passionate Kind. It came out about a month ago.
A month ago? It's brand new.
Brand new.
Yeah.
Just a baby.
Mm-hmm. Is it your first album?
It's actually my 11th.
Your 11th?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Yeah, it's, I started a long time ago. I think my first album came out in 2000. So,
uh-huh.
Yeah, and I've done one album a year for the last five albums. So, you know, there's a lot of new people that are finding out about me or something, and it's like, oh, is this your first or second album? I'm like, yeah, I should just say yes sometimes.
It's new to you,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Whoever you're talking to.
Yeah.
You drove up from Nashville today. We're here in mm-hmm. the Louisville Public Media Studios, and you said you're on your way to Cleveland.
Yeah, I have a show. My folks still live in Cleveland, and I have a show tomorrow in Cleveland, and I'm going to be there then for a week before heading out for some other shows.
Excellent. Well, thank you for making a stop for us
thank
here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I asked you to pick out five objects that mm-hmm. have some resonance or significance in your life, and we will find out more about you through these things that you've chosen. Where would you like to get started?
Yeah. Well, first of all, this is an amazing idea. And this was this was a chore. I could not think of
it's
what...
Hard.
I mean, a good chore, but I could not narrow it down. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I came up with five, but there's about five that got left off that I wanted.
I understand.
Yeah. But the first one I have is a Yomiuri, which is in Japan, Giants baseball hat that my brother gave me when he lived there.
Huh.
And my brother, he's quite a bit older than me. And when I was a kid, I really looked up to him. And mm-hmm. I saw he was this, while I grew up in outside of Cleveland, Ohio, and we were kind of a conventional family. One brother, Scott, was kind of the artistic kind of creative one, I guess. And he would always travel. And because he was about, let's see how much older he is, maybe between 15 and 20 years older.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Can't remember right
it's
now,
a good,
but
a good distance.
Good distance. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of at a launching point in his journey when I was just a kid.
Yeah,
he would go on these trips and he would ride away on his motorcycle with just his guitar on his back, and he would disappear for a while, and then he would suddenly come back, and there'd be some big homecoming for welcome back, and I just thought the world of him, and I thought it was such an unusual and amazing idea to see somebody that would wander, you know, mm-hmm. wander the world. And he lived in Puerto Rico, he lived in Chicago, he lived in New York, and at that point, he was going to Japan, and he was going to live there for a couple of years, and he didn't know anybody there or anything, and he was just going to move there to teach English mm-hmm. there. And so when he went away, I think I was like 11 or 12, I can't exactly remember, but and I would write him these letters all the time, mm-hmm. and for me, this young kid, I couldn't wait for his response, and it took a long time, usually, so I would check the mail every day, and you know, it takes a while to go all the way to Japan and back. And then when the letters would come in, I would be so excited. And I remember it was even on this different kind of stationery, you know, from Japan. And I would just take these letters and eat them up and get so inspired by them. And I was always a big sports fan. So at that time, I was really into the Cleveland Indians. And so he was telling me about the baseball leagues in his letters over there, because baseball is very big in Japan as well. He lived in Yokohama, which was the Whales. And but I actually called him to ask him about this because I couldn't remember why I wanted this particular team, which is the Yomiuri Giants. Uh-huh. And apparently they were the best team at that time. So that's why he sent me that one. Uh-huh. But he sent me back this hat. It was this black hat, the Y for Yomiuri, and then the G for the Giants. Mm-hmm. And I loved this hat, and I would wear it all over, and nobody would know who or what they were. And I'm sure I just said it's Tokyo Giants or something because they were outside of Tokyo.
Uh-huh.
My brother was really my first window to the world, and he would inspire me, and he would come back, and he would play music for me. He introduced me to Dylan. I remember one Christmas in particular, he brought home Tom Waits' Rain Dogs, which is such a wacky, cool album.
Yeah.
And also Leonard Cohen, one of his, I think The Future, one of his. And at that time, I think I was probably at now maybe like 16, 17 or something. But I didn't know that kind of music either. So I was really into blues at that time. And I remember he played those albums for me, and I thought, wow, people can do this with music. Like, it doesn't have to just stick with this, a conventional sound or anything. And mm-hmm. he was interested in theater things and all these things. So he became just a mentor, my first real mentor. Mm. And when I was older and got my first record deal and started touring, it was just awesome. I got to have him come with me for a year tour. Yeah. And he sang background vocals and played a whole heap of different instruments behind and everything. And it was a nice way to come full circle around that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I hear a lot from people about the music that their big brother introduced them to.
Mm.
Like that is definitely a common experience. And Leonard Cohen and Tom Waits are absolutely like big brother music, I think.
Yeah. Where are you going to hear that? And I grew up in Chardon, Ohio. You know, you're not going to hear that anymore.
Not on the radio or whatever. Yeah. Did he ever try to make a musical career for himself?
Not really. He was. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of theater. He did some theater stuff in New York and in Chicago. He kind of liked to blend things together. So mm-hmm. as far as with music, he never really sought to do that. But he was always playing it, or would bring it home. And he was the first one I saw with. I mean, my mom played guitar and she taught me and everything. But he would come back with it, and it was more almost an image of it. Of this guy, this wildly creative person who disappears with a guitar on his back on a motorcycle and then just comes home out of the blue. You don't know when he's coming home, somewhere around here. And it was very picturesque to me. I used to stand on this picnic table and kind of emulate him or emulate musicians with a tennis racket as a guitar. And it was the first thing that really got me excited about, performing and the art of traveling and all that kind of thing.
And it strikes me, too, that it's so different from, say, now where somebody like your brother going on a journey might put the whole thing on Instagram and you'd see where he is every day. And you were waiting for a letter to show up or maybe one day he'd surface.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think that's such a great point. I think they're back then, and not to sound like that back then guy, but really, I mean, there was a mystery. There was, you don't know where he is. A letter. You wait for a letter to know when you're going to hear from him again.
Mm-hmm.
So the second item is a chess table that my dad made. He made it, I believe, in the 60s. He went into carpentry school and he made it. It's beautiful. It's brown. I think it's walnut with stone on the top.
Mm.
And he always had this chessboard. And he taught me when I was, I believe, 8. And he taught me the first time, and the second time we played, I beat him. And it was a genuine I beat him. It wasn't like, I let my kids beat me.
Wow.
A couple times. And so we hardly played after that. But and it was the first time, like when chess was introduced to me, it totally knocked my socks off. It was just something about it I related to and I responded to. And I started playing right away. And I was quite good for a while. And I won a bunch of tournaments. And I knew that chess was going to be a part of my life for a long time. And it still is. And I wanted this table, and I asked for it a couple times, and the time wasn't right. And now I see as a father that you have to wait for the right time, to pass on those things.
So you wanted to teach your kids.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah. So he gave it to me recently, and I've wanted it for a long time. And it's such a wonderful thing to play on this board. And I've only, it's right now back in Ohio because we've moved around so much in the last couple of years, and I'm going to get it back for the next apartment, wherever, mm-hmm. wherever and whatever that may be. But I've played my sons on there. And, you know, in the past, I've played my father and my brother and my mother on there and everything. And in New York, I had this chess club and these chess nights, and we'd always play on the board and everything. And it just means a lot to me, both because obviously my father made it and it's a family heirloom, but also because I love chess.
What is it that you love about chess?
I think it's the thought process. And I've found that I operate on that in that way mm-hmm. on almost everything that I deal with, you know, very strategic and very protective, yet always thinking many steps ahead and everything. Right. And I've had to in the music industry, and it's weird that it ties in, but it does. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started, everything was done for me. It was way back in when nobody would put out your own album or mm-hmm. do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I had a manager, I had an agent, I had a label, I had a lawyer, and, you know, all I had to do was be creative and make music and show up, yeah. right? And now the least thing I do is be creative and show up, you yeah. know? And with that, you have to plan things. You have to think ahead. You have to manage so many aspects and little of them that really intersect with the creativity, you mm-hmm. know? I find that it's almost a similar thought process, that you really have to think ahead to tie it all together and everything. And I just think it's such a beautiful game. I've played it so much over the years and against so many people and in so many different places.
It's international, right? You can sit across from somebody yeah. at a chessboard and you don't have to have any language in common.
Yeah, I think my favorite experience was in Russia mm-hmm. because they didn't speak any English and I didn't speak any Russian. And it was just felt so cliche and perfect, you know, right. to be sitting there and playing somebody in chess. It also had this role in my life where it came back at certain times. Mm-hmm. Like when I first moved to New York, I lived up in Harlem, and there was this wonderful coffee place that unfortunately is not there anymore called the Society Coffee Club or something like that. And it was up in Harlem, and it was this just awesome, awesome place. And I would go all the time to this place, and I would write. One day there was this girl who was playing chess, and she was playing all these people and just whooping everybody. Mm-hmm. She was just gloating. Uh-huh. And I remember it was all men. She was playing all these guys and she was just going to town on them. And mm-hmm. And I hadn't played in a while at that point, but I was like, I'm going to try and play her. Uh-huh. I had to be kind of bold. I was kind of, it felt weird going in, walking into that circle, but I went in and played her and I beat her. And so because I beat her, she wanted to play me every day for like a month or so. And so we formed this relationship where we would meet up at this wonderful coffee club and play chess all the time. Mm-hmm. And it later came back because when I had to leave New York to do my third record, I think it was, and I was gone for a while and I couldn't get back. I couldn't figure out how to get back. Mm-hmm. New York can be a really tough place to get back once you leave. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any money or any of that, of course. And so she kind of out of the blue one day said, offered me a job there. And that was the job that got me back in an apartment. And, you know, so it had this significance as well as,
yeah.
you know, where it's taken me in life and stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely. And can I ask how old you are?
37.
37.
Yeah.
And how old were you when you got that first record deal?
Let's see. I was 20. 19 or 20.
Wow. Yeah. So you've seen a lot of change mm-hmm. in the music business.
It was nothing like now. And people think that I'm a lot younger than I am. So when I tell my story or anything like that, they think, wow, what does he know? And I'm like, when I talk about what the industry used to be like, and it was nothing like it is now. Something both exciting and also has been hard to navigate, you know, because
sure.
when I started, there was no digital world. There was nothing. It was just, and there was a big litmus test with the label, you know, uh-huh. and that comes with positives in mm-hmm. that well curated or
yeah.
perhaps. And then there's the negatives in that it's exclusively curated, you know.
Right.
So they pick who is part of the club.
Mm-hmm.
But what worked for me when I started was that, you know, I had an album on a label and then I was moving on towards other things. I got a second label deal for my second record and everything was kind of put forth for me, you know, mm-hmm. there's no gray area when it came to things.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I put out my next record, which I'll talk about later, was a long time, 5 years after that, everything was different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything. There was nothing that was the same about it, really. There's a million labels. Everybody does whatever they want. You put mm-hmm. out your own albums. Everything's digital. Everything's free now. You know, everything was very, very different. So
yeah,
when it started.
When you got your first record deal, did you think, like, okay, I've made it, that's it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
You think, you know, I remember thinking, I was going to win a Grammy. You know, yeah. you think that.
And how did that happen for you at such a young age? How did you get into the right room?
Yeah, I sent out a bunch of demos, and I remember just getting like a magazine with addresses from record labels.
Yeah,
yeah. And I made a demo, and I had a friend take a picture of me, and I packaged them up. I remember doing it with my mom, putting the packages on the living room floor and just sending them out, you know? And I remember hearing back from quite a few, you know, but you just wait and wait. And I remember like Alligator Records, which is a great little blues label in Chicago, responded. And it was with a no, but, you know, I was starting to get some responses.
Yeah, hey, it's an answer.
It's like, wow, okay. And then this little label out in Portland, Oregon, Burnside Records, sent me a letter and said, we really like this. Do you have more? And I was like, oh, wow, okay. So I started this relationship with them. And I think a year later or so, I signed with them. And yeah, I thought, wow, this is it, right? And I was too young. I was so young. And, you know, and I remember a friend of mine who was very well established, and he still is. And I was on tour with him, and he was a good friend of mine. And I remember him saying, you know, kind of tempering my feelings and being like, listen.
easy,
Tiger. And I remember one night in Chicago, it was so cold. And we were sitting in my RV because I had an RV, of course.
Uh-huh.
It's the only way to travel. So, and I remember him telling me, he said, I don't want to not encourage you, but you might have to pay your dues. And it might take a year. It might take 2 years. It might take 10 years. You don't know. And I was like, yeah, right. And here we are 20 years later.
Uh-huh.
And he was wrong because it wasn't just 10 years. The next one is a book, and this was really difficult because I love books, and books are such a big part of my life, and I have a book club with my mom, and we read all the classics again.
What?
And everything.
Oh, my. Yeah. Okay. We're going to go back and talk more about that.
Okay.
That's wonderful.
Okay.
Book
yeah.
club with your mom.
Yeah.
I love
it. Very exclusive club.
Just the two of you.
It's just the two of us. We uh-huh. have had other trial members,
uh-huh.
and nobody's fared well, And
you've got all these inside jokes, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. And we read at a pace, and
uh-huh.
and nobody else has any say. We've had some people come in and they're like, great, and they read one book with us, and then they're like, and how about this? And we're like, no. It's very, very exclusive club,
uh-huh.
you know, and we curate it years in advance. And
seriously.
Yeah.
Now, you said this focuses on the classics.
Yes, we mm-hmm. do. We do some other ones, but it's the classics that we really, really like, and some nonfiction ones. But
uh-huh.
by and large, we're kind of looking over all the lists and making sure that we hit everything.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, I totally took you away from the book you wanted to talk about, but I love that you have a book club with your mom.
Yeah.
How do you talk about them? Are you able to be together in person to actually talk, or over the phone? Or
we talk on the phone a little bit about it, and uh-huh. we text a lot about it.
Uh-huh.
I see her a lot, but usually when I see her, my two children are with us.
Yeah.
And so getting a free moment, all they want to do is be with grandma when
sure.
they're there. So it's very hard to get a word in. So we mostly talk about it by text message.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we do get together and have a moment, we'll go over it again.
Because, you know, I was just picturing you guys on the couch with wine and some appetizers and, you know.
Yeah, we do that. I mean, we do that too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But by and large, it's like, wow, page 46, you know, and can't believe that happened. Or
I love that.
Yeah, it's been awesome. It's really added a big thrill to the last 5 years just to do this, and to do it with my mother.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So what's the particular book you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so this particular book is not one that would fit under the book club criteria now,
okay.
but it's the one book that I think absolutely set me on my journey more than any other book, and that's Dharma Bums by Jack Kerouac. And I'm not sure this book would even hold up. Like, I tried to read him in recent years, and it didn't do the same thing it did for me then.
When did you first read it? How old were you?
I was in college, so maybe like 17 or 18.
That's when a lot of people first get
their
first taste of Jack Kerouac.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly. And it's, you know, you read it and you're like, wow, this is, you know, especially if you haven't read, you know, coming from a Catholic high school, so you didn't we didn't read anything subversive or, and it felt maybe not even subversive on some perverse way, but it felt very subversive on this, like, what we do in society way, you know?
Showing you a different way to be.
Yeah. And it kind of, and it went hand in hand with what my brother, seemingly his lifestyle had been. And when I first read this book, I just remember being floored first by the Buddhism part. Like I had never heard anything, any of the tenets of Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I really connected with it. I really thought that this idea of spiritual traveling was incredible. Mm. And the whole time I was in college, I felt like I loved it and I had a wonderful time, but I felt like I was just on this temporary thing. I knew I was off for something different and I just wanted to get there. So I finished college in 3 years and I just like, I did it as almost as an obligatory thing. Mm.
And what was your degree in?
I had a double major in political science and natural resources. Mm. And I knew I wanted to do music, but at some points I was like, I want to go to music school or the music programs. And I took a couple classes. Mm-hmm. I didn't care for them. I didn't feel like they made me well-rounded because I knew I wanted to do music. So I wanted to learn something else. And I was very interested in politics and environmental studies at that time. I learned a lot, but I felt like I was on borrowed time at college. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was off to somewhere. I just wanted to get there fast. So I just remember reading this book, just reading the whole thing really, really fast and just eating up the whole aspect of, like, put yourself out there. Be a loner and travel and look for the inner meaning of all these things. You can't hop a train anymore.
Yeah.
But you could take a Greyhound bus. Mm-hmm. So directly from this, I started to take buses to places on the weekends and by myself. And I have to say, taking a Greyhound bus by yourself at that period did feel probably somewhat similar to what it might have felt
like. Character building.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it was such an enlivening experience because I was scared, you know, and you're meeting people that are talking to you in a way that you've never been spoken to before. Mm. And you're having to dodge things and people and ideas and everything. And I started taking these on almost every weekend. And it was on one of these buses that I heard somebody talking about the Appalachian Trail. I had never heard of it. And so I remember saying, what's the name of this trail? And he said, the Appalachian Trail. And I had never heard of it. And I went back to my dorm or wherever I was. And I said, I'm going to do that. I read up on it a little bit and it said, you have to do all this training and everything. I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that, but I'm going to do this trail. And so I talked to my professors and I talked them into letting me leave a month early. On the other side, when I would go back, I got them to say I could start a little late.
Oh, wow.
And they let me make it up. And I was a really good student in college, so they were fine with it. And it was.
And you were planning to do the whole thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did. So I did it like a couple months later. I just said, I'm going to do it. And it
also. By yourself?
Yeah. Well, I started with somebody. He didn't last very long. So I started with a friend and then did the whole thing myself mostly, most of it. That's where I wrote my first album. I brought a little Martin backpacker guitar, which would have been one of the five things had I not errantly given it out at one point.
Oh, no.
Which I deeply regret. Mm. But it directly led me to the trail, which I did, and which has given me a real sense of the journey, which is what I was looking for from that Kerouac book, was the idea of this journey and of this, you know, this spiritual journey and the solo journey that you make. And it also, so it had that angle, so it did the trail and all that. But then the other angle is one of the trips on the Greyhounds that I took was to Chicago to see this guy named Anders Osborne. I'm not sure if you know who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell our listeners about Anders Osborne.
He's a singer-songwriter from New Orleans, and he's a wonderful player, wonderful artist. And he's got a big following in like both the New Orleans side of things and also some of the jam scene. Mm-hmm. But deep down, he's just even above and beyond those things, he's just this songwriter and this artist and this creative person that knows no limits to his creativity and his artistry. But my brother, who we talked about from the Giant's Hat earlier, had heard him on the radio. And he said, wow, there's this guy I heard on the radio. It was really great. His name was Anders Osborne. And I was like, oh, cool. I saw he was playing in Chicago, and I was like, well, I'm going to take a Greyhound there and check this guy out.
Yeah.
And so it really went with the code of what I was trying to do and what I was reading and hoping to live my life that way. And so I took the bus out there. I found this place where Anders was playing, and I met him that night. And I was really inspired by his performance. And he had this sousaphone player named Kirk Joseph, who later became a friend. And it was just such an awesome experience. And then on my way back, I got lost and mugged and all that. But when I got back, I really remember Anders. And when I got signed to a record deal after the Appalachian Trail, they were like, well, we're going to come up with a producer for you. And I was like, what about that guy? And they were like, I don't know. And they had all these people they had in mind. And I stood my ground. And I said, I really want Anders Osborne. And I didn't know anything at that time. Like, I didn't know how you get somebody like,
yeah, right, how it works.
Yeah, I met him, mm-hmm. but I was like an 18-year-old kid, you know, he meets people every day. So I made a cassette and I sent it to him. No, I sent it to his manager. And maybe a month later, while we were still trying to determine who was going to produce it, I got a call from Anders. And they said that he and his family, you know, they get these things all the time, but he and his family were dancing to it all day and he wanted to do it. So he produced my first record and he became my mentor. And I lived with him in New Orleans for a while. And he taught me, you know, where my brother taught me so much in those first formative years. And then Anders taught me so much about, you know, the next stage and these grown-up years where he's the guy who told me you're going to have to pay your dues, yeah. since I talked about that earlier. But, you know, I learned from him year after year. He produced 4 or 5 of my albums and written with him a ton and just really admire the guy and gained a lot of knowledge from him.
Thing.
Yes, okay.
Next page of notes.
Ah, okay. yeah, I took notes. I was prepared.
Excellent.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one is a slash. There's two kind of items kind of geared into one.
Okay.
I don't know if that breaks the rules.
That's fair.
So.
That's fair.
But it's this album, You Must Believe in Spring, which is a jazz album by Bill Evans,
uh-huh.
Which is also the tattoo that I got here. So it's, okay. I didn't know if a tattoo could be a thing.
Sure.
Yeah. But this album, it's a jazz album. It's a really melancholic album,
mm-hmm.
And it's all piano. He did it with the trio. It's a sad album, but it's a sad album that has this feeling that the protagonist feels like it's going to get better at mm-hmm. some point. But in that moment, you know,
yeah.
they're hoping and longing. And Bill Evans was a sad character as far as his life, and
yeah.
He struggled with addiction his whole life. His wife committed suicide, and I believe one of his bandmates did. And he just struggled, and you can feel it in his music, and it's this beautiful struggle, you know. It reminds me kind of some of, like, James Baldwin's writing. It's just, it's got this ferocious sadness, but told in a tender way.
Mm-hmm.
And this album, somebody handed it to me on this one particular winter, which was the first winter that I knew about sadness, like,
mm-hmm.
really knew about it. It was my second year out. My story was I had my first album, and then I got signed to a bigger label.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be this big thing, and I was ecstatic. The world was my oyster, all that. And I got asked to do this big tour, this Christmas tour, with the Blind Boys of Alabama and Mavis Staples and Aaron Neville.
Mm.
And Chrissy Hynde, too, was on it.
Holy moly, that's...
Yeah, it was big stuff.
So exciting.
So exciting, and it was... and I was still very young, you know. Mm-hmm. I was 22, maybe, or something. And I had only 1 year of touring, a year and a half, about, under my belt. I was ecstatic for this tour and overwhelmed and terrified and all these things. And it was just when I had gotten signed to this next big deal. And
mm-hmm.
I had already done the record. I had just done it, my second album, which in itself had been a lesson learner and taught me all sorts of things. But I was coming out of that and I was, you know, I was ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But this tour, it went south real fast for me. And what happened, I never talked about this before on a radio or anything, so I'm trying to think of how to say this, but the first show was in Columbus, Ohio, and it was wonderful, and it's a standing ovation, blah, 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 blah. But the second show was in Boston, which is where my label was based. And I remember this night, it was the coldest day of the year, they'd said, for, you know, in history in Boston, blah, blah, blah. And it really was. I remember it being so cold. And I remember there was this feeling before the show that something, I wasn't welcome. It just, I had this feeling, and I couldn't get in touch with anybody, where to park, and it was at this big performance center, the Berkeley Performance Center, which is a really big place, thousands of people in there and everything. And I remember before the show not knowing where to park. There was no place there, and then I remember walking very far to get to the show, and it was freezing, and getting in there and just feeling unwelcomed. And it just spilled over to the show, and I got booed off the stage. And it was, you know, I was very young, and I didn't know how to process this.
Yeah.
And I remember after the show, I was kind of like hanging out. It was this big performance center. So I remember hanging out in the halls and just kind of being a little bit in a fog and wondering, what just happened?
Yeah.
You know, I did the same show the night before and just thinking, well, what happened? What went wrong? And then the next morning, I got up and I was driving to Ohio. And it was a long drive to fly to Boulder for the next night of the show, of the tour. So the first couple shows were on the East Coast, and then it went to the West Coast. And as I was driving, I got a call that, oh my gosh, did you see the review? And I was like, no, what? And so there was this a review on me that was just scathing. And what I don't mean scathing, like, it wasn't very good. Like, it was this personal barbed attack in one of the major Boston papers. And it went really out of its way to take me down in a way that a child doesn't understand. And so it became this big thing. And they were talking about whether or not I would continue on the tour. Other promoters on the West Coast were hearing about this opening act that was terrible, you know. I didn't know how to handle it.
Sure.
And I, when I got back to my parents' house in Ohio, where I was to leave the next morning for Boulder, Colorado, I didn't even know if I wanted to do anymore. You know, it was such a traumatic experience. Yeah. And, you know,
it's the reason they tell people don't read your reviews.
Well, I mean, I've read plenty of them, but this one, it had a personal, I mean, there was a backstory. The guy who wrote it's girlfriend was trying to get on the same label, and they rejected her. And then, because there was some, you know, but who knows?
Yeah,
all I know is that there was quite a response from this, and that they were debating on whether or not to take me off the tour. And so I remember going back to this room and just feeling like I wasn't sure I even wanted to continue.
Sure.
And then I remember calling Anders, who was still my mentor, and he said, "No, you have to do this. You want to quit? I know, but don't. You got to do this. You got to get through this." And he said, "You have to beg to stay on this." I was like, okay. So I kind of did, and they kind of said, okay, you know. And then the next night was a success. And so I was like, okay. And I remember Aaron Neville was standing on the side of the stage during the whole set. And every night when I would come off the stage, he'd say that I had something really special. And it really helped me get through.
Oh, wow.
You know? But all that said and done, when the tour was finished, it was a nightmare for me because the label was there, and they couldn't get past it. The article referenced them, you know, specifically, and saying, who did I know to get this and all this stuff. And there was such a fallout from this that when I got done with the tour, I didn't know what was next. Yeah. And I knew that they were going to release, and I'm using air quotes because nobody can see. They were going to release the album, but they told me they were not going to do anything behind it. And so what happened is I got tied up in that, and it really had an effect on my next moves and everything. And I remember where this album comes in is that winter was just a cold winter.
Yeah.
And I was afraid to leave my room. I was afraid to start again, you know. And it was this winter where I discovered jazz. I discovered Miles and Coltrane and Bill Evans. And I felt it. It really resonated with me that winter. You know, I needed to get the strength to get back out there. And I remember listening to You Must Believe in Spring over and over again and feeling like, yeah, I feel down right now. And I don't see the path to getting back out right now, but I know I will.
Mm.
And I did. You know, when spring came, Anders actually called and he said, why don't you come down here, stay with me for a while.
To New Orleans.
Live here. He said, just learn to live. Learn music. Learn all this stuff. And I did. And it was just so special. New Orleans is a place like no other. And I learned how to play there. I learned how to dance. I learned how to see life very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And going to jazz funerals and these things were so foreign to me and so beautiful to see, especially as a young kid. And eventually that led me to, I moved from New Orleans to Los Angeles and then from Los Angeles to New York. When this album then came back to me, I think it would have been two or three years later.
Mm-hmm.
And New York was hard to get into, and it wasn't easy. And keep in mind, from this experience in Boston and this record, I didn't put out an album for 5 years.
Mm.
And it was frustrating, and I couldn't figure it out. And so I got to New York, and I was moving around, both trying to find how to, you know, get back out there.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, everything was changing in the music industry. So I got to New York, and, you know, it's an expensive city. And so you start getting these little jobs, and you start getting further and further away from the traveling musician that you were. Mm-hmm. And there was this one, I think it was 2007 or 8, this winter, and I was working this silly job watching daycare for dogs, which was fun in its own way. But, you know, it's not what I was supposed to be doing, obviously. And it just seemed like I didn't know how to get back to where I was creating music. I hadn't had an album out 5 years. I felt like there was so much to work from in the early days, and here we were, and I couldn't quite figure out how to do it anymore. And I remember that winter while I was at the dog place, and I bring my guitar in there, and me and 25 dogs would sing our songs, and that I would find a way, and I had to. And this album meant a lot to me. Fifth thing is a mandolin that was given to me from my dad, but from my great-grandfather in Italy. Mm. And it's, I'll have to describe it as best I can, but it's a potato bug mandolin. Mm-hmm. So it's shaped like...
like the back of it is rounded. Is
very round. Yeah, very round. Like an oval almost. Mm-hmm. And it's from Italy, from the 1800s. And my great-grandfather had brought it over from Messina, Sicily. And I know that it had made its way down from him to what would be my grandfather, and then my grandfather to my dad. And then my dad handed it to me, but it was all ruined. I mean, it was totally smashed and everything, and I had it reinstored. So I have this mandolin, and I do play it from time to time, but it's not super playable. You know, you can play it, but it's not, it doesn't sound great because it's very warbly, for lack of a better word. To me, this mandolin means a lot because I like to envision the journey that my great-grandfather took. And it also makes me think of how spoiled we are now, like, as far as us Americans, you know, that the journeys people used to have to take and the journeys that people are still having to take, you know, they're still having to take that journey. Think about people hopping on a train from Guatemala and having to get through drug lords and leave situations where they have two choices, you know, to stay in their community and get into a gang or to do a dangerous trip to go up to a place where maybe they'll get welcomed, you know? Yeah. That's a huge thing. I can't imagine myself doing that. And nobody could imagine themselves doing it unless they're put to having to do that, you know?
And so was that kind of your great-grandfather's story? What do you know about?
I don't know that much. I know that they were very poor, and I know that there wasn't that at that time, you know, a lot of people from Europe were heading to America for jobs and for opportunities. And I think about what journey he must have taken, and while I don't know that much, I know that they came to Cleveland and Chicago, and then Cleveland, you know, from Ellis Island. I like to think about this story, and I like to think about what it might have been like to get on a boat and take all your belongings, or just a couple of belongings, and your family, and to not know what it's going to be like when you get there, and to not know if you're going to actually even get in, you know, or if you're just going to have to turn around and go right back there.
And he chose to bring this mandolin.
Yeah.
Right?
And from what I understand, he wasn't the most musical of the family. Like, he hardly could play it, but he wanted to bring it back, and I think other people in his family could play it and everything. But he only could bring a couple things, and he brought a mandolin, so I always thought that was pretty cool. And like to think about, you know, where the wood of that mandolin has been, and the salt of the sea in there, and all sorts of things that go into making an instrument what it is.
Have you been to the place where your family is from?
I've been to Italy, but I've not been to Messina, Sicily. But anytime I get to go to Italy a couple times, well, once a year usually for a tour, and I always take my family, my wife, and my kids, and we have a blast. It's really special to be there, but I have never been to Sicily, which I'd like to at some point, and to Messina in particular.
Sounds like that's a trip you need to take at some point.
Exactly, yeah.
So did you grow up in, like, an Italian community? Were there lots of other Italian Americans around? Was that a big part of your identity growing up?
It was a part of it, but I wouldn't say it was an extreme part of it. It was I was always around like my dad's side of the family, and they're all Italian Americans. Mm-hmm. And my grandma spoke Italian. She never taught any of us or anything, but some of the parts of town that they lived in were certainly very heavily Italian. And I always felt proud that my name was Bucaro, and which I'm corrected every time I go there. They say, no, it's Bucaro. So,
oh.
But you don't say Bucaro your whole life and then change it because one Italian tells you so, mm-hmm. right?
And I wonder if that was something musical that was kind of that was in your family. I mean, that was one of the things that your great-grandfather brought with him.
Yeah. I'm told that there was a lot of music in their history. I think that music back then was more of a group thing in general. Everybody kind of did it, you
know? Not a professional
thing. Yeah, not like it was how communities socialized in a lot of ways. And I think that's how this mandolin probably was for my great-grandfather without knowing. To me, yes, it tells more of a story about the thread of music as well. And has been music in my family. My father was a DJ at a station that played classical and country for a little bit. And my mom has always loved music and introduced me to stuff. And her dad came from a gospel tradition in the South. And my sister played classical piano. And I presume, obviously, when my kids are older, you know, I'm sure I'll pass it down to them, and I have a feeling one or both of them will have some sort of musical or artistic inclination. So, yeah.
All right. Well, it's about time for us to wrap up. I've got one last question for you. Mm-hmm. In the course of putting together, choosing these five things, was there anything that you think you might have learned about yourself?
I think when I was trying to put together the five, one thing that I realized first was that I actually don't have that many keepsakes. Mm. That was the first thing I noticed, is I have all these things, but a lot of them are based more on memories. Mm-hmm. And I was at my parents' house, because I was kind of laid up there for a while this summer, and I was looking through all sorts of things, and I realized that I really didn't have a lot of particular keepsakes, and that I hadn't held on to a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, the Martin backpacker guitar would be perfect. And then I remembered, oh, no, you randomly gave that to some person that you'll never see again. Or, yeah, there were lots of things like that in moving from apartment to apartment over the years that has been purged. So I learned that. And I also remembered some of these aspects of my journey in those formative years, you know, because they're far away now. They're over 10 years away. But it made me remember what it was that sparked some of these desires to go places or try an uphill climb in music or this or that. And so it was really wonderful to reminisce and to keep hold of what it was that meant something to me then. And it gives me a challenge to find new aspects of the journey that can be represented by times and things and stuff. You know, I kept trying to pick something that my kids made. And then two points. One is I realized that my kids had broken a lot of the things.
Oh, of course. Oh.
Like the album, they broke that one. So I was So I couldn't, there were plenty of things that I realized, you know, when you have kids, you start to get less and less attached to things because if you do and then they break it, exactly. You're devastated, right? Gosh. So, especially in those early years. So I realized that a lot of those keepsakes, quote unquote, probably had been ruined in the child rearing game. And then the second thing was that there was too many wonderful things that they had given, but not one particular thing that kind of represented them. So I just thought, well, I'll intersperse family life into all the other things that led there. So
absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. And this is such a wonderful show, a wonderful idea, really.
It's a lot of fun. Thanks again to Clarence Bucaro for being my guest today. Our show was produced, edited, and mixed by me, with editing oversight from Laura Ellis. Our theme music is by Alex Wright. You can get more information on our show at WFPL.org. This is the last show for the current season. We'll be taking a little hiatus while I work on launching another podcast project, but planning to be back before too long. You can keep up with me on Twitter at Tara E. Anderson for updates, animal videos, and other things I think you'd enjoy. As always, thanks for listening.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.